Perhaps nothing holds families together more than our stories. Perhaps nothing tears families apart more than those same stories. You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're bringing you a conversation with author Lori Herzl. Herzl spent 15 years as the book editor at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Her latest book is called Ghosts of Fourth Street, My Family, a Death, and the Hills of Duluth. Now, the manuscript of this book sat in a desk drawer for years because Herzl wasn't sure how her family might react to the narrative about her childhood in Duluth, Minnesota. The longing for connection, the loss of her older brother, the stories whispered, the stories shouted. We begin here when I asked her what kind of child she was.
I was number 7 of 10, so it was a busy, crowded house with a lot of people in it and one bathroom. And I was pretty shy. I was a reader, an avid reader. I learned to read at a very early age, and that was kind of my escape from everything. I didn't like noise. I didn't like crowds. There is a scene in the book, the summer that I, right before I turned 3, my family moved to St. Joseph, Missouri to live for the summer with my father's parents. And it was not a big house. And so there were, at that point, there were 7 of us and twins on the way, and my parents and my grandparents, and my father's little sister lived there as well. So it was a very busy house. And I used to sneak out of the house and go across the alley to where my 2 maiden great aunts lived and just be with them. And it was just so peaceful. They had a very quiet house. They would tie my shoes and brush my hair, and I would help them make cookies. And that was what I liked. I liked being alone. I liked calm, which is hard to find in a house of 12 people.
In fact, at one point you're reading, I think it's a magazine, and because you're flipping the pages too quickly, your mother puts you to work because she knows you're not really reading. So talk about reading in your family, because it was encouraged and allowed, but within boundaries.
Yeah, we were a very bookish family. My father was an English professor, and later in life, after the kids were a little older, my mother became a librarian. We all read. We got books for Christmas. We got books for birthdays. There were books, you know, up I lived in the girls' room with 3 of my sisters, and we had a bookshelf full of books. And my father had a room in the basement that was full of books. And so, yeah, very much encouraged. It was part of our lives, part of our daily lives. We subscribed to a lot of newspapers. We got magazines in the mail. You know, my mother would pick up the women's magazines, but she also read, you know, The New Yorker. And I got a subscription to Highlights for Children. And reading was really front and center in our house. It was encouraged.
But your father didn't think those books should be displayed.
No, it was kind of funny. Yeah.
How do you think about that today?
He did tell me that it was show-offy to display your books in the main level of the house. That I don't know where he got this idea. You know, he grew up in a pretty blue-collar home, and he did go to college, obviously became a professor. But there was a bookcase in the front hallway, and there was a bookcase in the dining room that held encyclopedias. But the bulk of the books were either upstairs or in the basement. And he actually even had boxes of books up in the attic. I don't know. He thought it was a blue-collar, show-offy thing to display your books. And I think he used as an example the people who subscribe to, like, the series Great Books of the Western World, or, you know, that kind of thing. And he kind of looked down on that. You know, that's not really, you know, reading. That's kind of showing off. So, I mean, it could also really have been a matter of space. It was a pretty crowded house, you know, and you have to have a dining room table big enough for 12 people. And, you know, it could have been partly that as well. But that stuck with me. And, you know, I have always had books on the main floor of my house because I have always had small houses, and I just put books wherever they fit. I remember an apartment I had in Duluth when I was in my 30s or 20s, and I've never been much of a cook, and so there was like all these kitchen cupboards, and it's like, this is great, and I put my books in the kitchen cupboards because, ready-made bookshelves, right?
I love that. We talk about remembering, and there's a story in the very beginning of the book where you're telling about seeing as a child. You mentioned like these memories from when you're three, four, very young memories, and you see a wagon wheel. Tell us a little bit about that frustration and how you remember, even as an adult, the frustration of not having your memory taken seriously.
Yeah, that was did I really see a wagon wheel? I don't know. It was when we first moved to Duluth in the evening that we all went to see the house. We didn't stay there because there was no furniture yet, but I ran through the house, and there were these big windows that looked out on the backyard, and there's a little garage in the back, and there was a wagon wheel perched on top of the peak of the garage, and I was calling to people to come and look at this, come and look at this, and nobody did. I mean, everybody's looking at the house, and it's chaos, and there's babies, and no one's paying any attention. And the next day when we came back to the house, it wasn't there. So most likely, looking back on that time, it was some kind of trick of the light, or I saw something and saw it wrong. But yes, what I remember is the frustration of nobody listening to me. And then later they would tease me about it. Remember that time Laura saw the wheel on the garage? Ah, ha, ha. And they would, they'd come up with these alternative possibilities. It could have been this, it could have been that. And it did. It frustrated me that nobody took me seriously, and no one, they wanted to change my memory into something else, and maybe they thought they were trying to help me solve the puzzle or whatever, but I just felt like, you're not listening. This isn't what I saw. I know what I saw.
Yeah, which gets to this idea of being a child and writing the truth about childhood in your family from the perspective of this is what I saw. And a couple of things you say in the book, it's not journalism. And then I read in an interview, you said there's a reason the book isn't, 400 pages. You didn't put anything in there that you didn't know was true to your memory. So how, as a journalist and as a memoirist, did you start making those decisions about dialogue, about remembering a story that you only saw when you were 8 or 9, and understanding that other people had a different perspective of it? Walk us through that, if you would.
Yeah, I tried to make it very clear in the opening of the book that these are my memories. They are strong memories. I don't know if they're accurate, honestly. I mean, memory is such a slippery thing. And I mean, the more you think about things, and I have thought about these things throughout my life, they've been a very active part of my brain. But that the more you think about things, the more you accidentally change them because you become, you grow older and you have other experiences, and that's going to color how you remember things, even though you think you're remembering it exactly the same every single time. So I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware that a lot of these things are going to come up against memories that members of my family had, and they're not going to fit. But I do not have a lot of dialogue in the book. There's very little dialogue in the book. The dialogue that's in there, I remember, but there's not, I don't have pages of, conversations and back and forths because, I didn't remember that sort of thing. I would say that everything in the book is true to me, but I don't know if it's true. You know what I mean? I mean, I know the facts are true. My brother died, and, the things around that certainly happened. But the feelings that I had, the impressions that I had, like the wheel on the garage, I could have seen something and misconstrued, right? So that's a very tricky thing. And how did I write it? I just started writing it in pieces, and it's still sort of in pieces when you read it. It's very piecemeal. But I, writing the things that I remembered all, kind of leading up to the day my brother died.
Yeah. Before we talk about your brother, I want to go back to that pineapple sundae, the ice cream. And there's so many moments throughout this book where I could think of something that happened in my own childhood where I was like, oh, I thought I was the only one, from just all these little details. So much of your family is unique, but I think you do such a beautiful job of capturing what childhood is, especially in a small town in the Midwest. Your father wants to take you out for ice cream and he selects the ice cream for you. Talk a little bit about what it means to like have a father who's trying to share something with you, but yet you're a kid and you don't like the thing that you're learning how to express your own preference and you come up against his rage, really.
I didn't like pineapple. He wanted to buy me a pineapple sundae. And it's funny because I wrote that story, a different version of it, obviously, but I wrote that the first time when I was in my early 20s and a friend of mine had had a baby. And I told her this story, and she thought the story was hilarious because she was looking at it from the point of view of a mother, a parent who wants to plan everything for her child and make sure that her child gets exactly what she wants, and it doesn't work. And she said, "You should write that down." And when I wrote it, it was a sad story. There's nothing really funny about that story. And it's because I was writing from the point of view of the child. I was a child who was singled out of 10 kids for this special trip to go, to Bridgman's and get this ice cream treat, but it was the wrong ice cream treat. And my father, both of my parents, I think, were overwhelmed by so many children. They were really young when they got married. I think my mother was 19. My father was like maybe 2 years older, just back from the war. And my father was in college still when they started having these babies. And my mother was too, but she had to, drop out. And baby, 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 year after year after year, more and more babies. So they were young. They didn't have much money. They were pretty much ill-equipped. Neither one of them came from like great role model homes. And I think my father tried to manage things by setting really strict rules and expectations and trying to control us. And it didn't work. The more that he tried to rein us in, the more we rebelled, really. I mean, probably me less than some of my other siblings who were a little more spirited. I was more hanging back and observing. But it was not a successful way to parent. So he would get mad, and I think he would get mad because he was so frustrated that, we weren't doing what he wanted. So he had this trip planned. He was going to take me to Bridgman's, buy me this ice cream sundae, and all I could think about was, oh, please, I want it to be hot chocolate instead. What kind of chocolate was it?
Yeah, hot fudge, yeah.
Hot fudge sundae.
Yeah.
But I was afraid to tell him that because he had built this up as let's go do this thing.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, you could just see disaster coming from a long way away.
Lori, I think that's just so hard to do as a writer, is to capture the how important those things can be for children. You read the Little House books growing up, of course, like many of us did, and that was one of the masterful things about that book was, the orange in the toe of the stocking, which you also have and write about the things that matter in childhood, and being able to remember them, describe them, and put yourself back in the place of that child. Would you have written this book if Bobby hadn't died?
No, probably not. Probably not. Then it would have just been a book about a kind of chaotic family where we all kind of grew up and moved on. I mean, that was the thing that really, I think, in many ways, defined us as a family. The younger kids were too young to remember that, but after he died, I mean, my father kind of disappeared emotionally and physically too. He was gone a lot, for several years and was drinking because of grief, I'm assuming. And my mother just decided all of her other children had disappointed her in different ways, and she was going to start over with the three younger ones, which did not include me. So it kind of fractured the family in a way, and that fracture still exists in many ways. The three younger ones are very tight, very close, and not very close with the rest of us who had been deemed disappointments. So I'm not sure I'm not sure I would have felt the need to write about it. I mean, I thought about my brother's death a lot throughout my young adulthood. The first time that it really moved me was on my 18th birthday, because he died 2 weeks after his 18th birthday. And so I remember turning 18 and thinking, oh my God, if I was him, I would have 2 weeks to live. And that really just kind of made it much more real than it had ever been, because I was 9 when he died. And, you know, there were 5 kids between us in age. And so he and I weren't close, obviously. I mean, he was much older than I was. So when he died, and, you know, a 9-year-old does not have really well-developed emotions. You know, I wasn't mature yet as far as feeling things and understanding what was going on that level. So it was something that kind of haunted me more the older I got, and I thought about it more and more. And I started writing about it when I was in high school, just that piece of my childhood. And so it eventually became this book.
You talk throughout the book about different kinds of stories, stories that your mother hated because they're about your father's family, stories that were whispered and never told, stories that you wish you remembered, that your father told you that so forgotten stories, stories that you were told that there are consequences for telling as an adult, and then stories that you always told and told again among brothers and sisters as sort of self-preservation stories. All about stories and their role in our lives. It's everything. In some ways, it's everything. What did I miss in the list of stories and how they intersect with our lives?
Well, there were also stories that my father used to sit at the dining room table after dinner before my brother died and tell stories about when he and my mother were first married and how they lived in this one rented room with, you know, him as a baby, and maybe his brother had been born by then too. But, you know, they had no money. It was the Great Depression and they had nothing. And he told stories from his childhood, and he would say that he thought it was very important that we understood where he had come from, because he was proud of the fact that, you know, from this one little rented room during the Depression, you know, he went on to college and became a professor, and, you know, we have this house and this nice life. But there were other stories too, a lot of ghost stories that kind of defined a branch of his family, his mother's side mainly. So I grew up thinking we have these incredible stories that define us as a family, and not realizing that all families have these stories, right? So the theme of story is, I think, the main theme of the book, the stories that defined us, the stories that kind of made us a tribe, the stories my mother never told, because she really did not talk much at all about her childhood or her life, at least not to me. She was very close to one brother. Then I think she told him a lot of things that none of us will ever know. And yeah, the stories that we told, you know, during times when he was angry or upset, and we had to sort of let each other know that, you know, he's on a rampage and we should just go hide. Yeah. And then the stories that I read in the books too. I mean, I read all the time. That was my thing.
If I may, the stories were always dramatic. Many were violent, and some involved ghosts, though they differed somewhat in the details depending on who was telling them, morphing and changing over time. The stories were always recounted as God's honest truth. They were told without irony. They were our history, our identity, and our legacy. Surely nobody else had such a passionate, sensitive, interesting family. Surely no other family was bound as tightly as ours. Surely these stories set us apart. Page 25. I absolutely love that. I underlined that whole passage.
Oh, thank you. But who doesn't think that about their own family and their own family stories, right? We all have family stories, and I think that is what kind of binds us together as a family.
Would you read a section for us here as we close? You have set it up because you have a difficult relationship with your mother, especially because she didn't want some of these stories to be told. But I think that you paint such a tender portrait of a complicated woman in this book. I think that part's really well done. Go
Yeah,
ahead.
my mother never wanted children, or she told us that. She told us that quite often. And then she married my father, who was Catholic. She had to convert to Catholicism because his mother was like a very domineering person in their lives until they moved to Duluth. So she just kind of pulled back from everything, and she pulled back from her children as well. She was not a warm an attentive mother. And I spent, you'll see in this book, I spent a good deal of time kind of following her around and wishing she'd pay more attention to me, or, hug me, or, and I don't want to sound too pathetic because I think I had a fine childhood, but she was just not a giving, warm person. I think she gave as much as she could, but 10 children is a lot. So this little passage is from when I was sick one time. And the girls' room, three of my sisters and I shared the girls' room. The boys' room was next door with three of my brothers, and then the back bedroom was the three little kids. So it was a crowded house. From where I lay, small and hot under a mound of blankets, I could hear cars hissing wetly as they passed along 4th Street in the melting snow. The day before, our class had celebrated Valentine's Day, and red paper hearts and cartoonish bee mines were scattered over my sister's bed where I rested, plumped up with pillows, feeling sick and safe. My skin was tender, my muscles ached, I was hot, I was cold. I had been sick all night, and in the morning, Trish, that's my mother, we did not call our parents mom and dad, had moved me from my mattress on the floor to Kristen's bed, and I didn't have to go to school. The light in the room was bright, and it seemed to be from sunshine, but it was really from the thickly falling snow, white filling the air. The window was open just a little, and I could hear the cars passing by our house, and there were valentines all over my blankets. And here came Trish, walking through the doorway of the girls' room, carrying a brown tray with a glass of 7-Up and a saucer of saltines. Everyone else was at school and Gov was at work, and it was just Trish and me and the throw-up pan nearby on a chair, but I knew I wouldn't need it anymore. I was feeling a little better, no longer queasy, but I wasn't going to tell her that, not yet. The red hearts of the paper valentines and the cereal box that I had cut down and decorated to use as a valentine's mailbox in school, as all the children had, were scattered across the bed, and outside the cars glided past, and inside was Kristen's big bed with the bookcase headboard that I could lean against when I sat up. Trish pressed her hand to my forehead, and her hand was nice, a soft touch that I almost never felt, cool and strong, and she said, "You're burning up." And I was glad to be burning up if it meant that I got to lie in Kristen's bed with Valentine's and my mother's touch. And I wriggled back down into the covers and closed my eyes and said, "Don't go away," feeling the power of my illness and great contentment, listening to the cars pass by on the wet street outside in the snow, my mother's hand, oh, so briefly touching my face.
I think that's just about perfect.
Oh, thank you. It's something I
The
remember so vividly, especially the cars. It was February and there'd been a little bit of a melt, Things were wet outside.
Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that for us. It's a beautiful book, Ghosts of 4th Street, My Family, a Death in the Hills of Duluth, out this week from the University of Minnesota Press. Lori Herzl, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.